Charles versus Verhagen. Do you wish to proceed, ma'am? She can argue for that.
She's working her way at it.
May it please the court, I'm Jody Schmelzer, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, and I represent the defendant appellants in this case, officers of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. In this case, the defendant challenged the constitutionality of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which I will refer to as RLUIPA. The first point that I will be addressing is that RLUIPA is unconstitutional under the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. I address this point first because of the three cases that have held RLUIPA unconstitutional. They've done so on Establishment Clause grounds.
All district court cases, right?
Two district court cases, Your Honor, one out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, one out of the Western District of Virginia, one Superior Court case out of the state of California.
Right, so this is a question of first impression, well, not really, because the Ninth Circuit, which you're asking us to conflict with, has ruled to the contrary, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. RLUIPA violates the Establishment Clause because it has the primary effect of advancing religion, and to a reasonable observer, that being a prison inmate, this statute is viewed as an endorsement of religion.
Is it forced religion on any prisoner who wishes to be an atheist?
I believe it does, Your Honor. And there's how.
Does it force them to buy religious artifacts?
It does not.
Does it force them to attend religious services?
No, it doesn't.
Faith?
Not directly.
Well, how does it indirectly?
It's a statute that, when applied in the prison setting, is going to elevate religious rights over any other fundamental right that an inmate may exercise. In the prison realm, the Turner test, which is whether or not a provision infringing on a constitutional right of an inmate is reasonably related to legitimate penological goals, that's the test that applies to all fundamental rights for all inmates exercising those fundamental rights.
So, but wait a minute. I mean, we know about Turner, but it seems to me that the essence of your argument is that in the prison context, Congress exhausts its powers when it protects the free exercise rights of prisoners, which they surely have. No one has ever held that prisoners may be banned from attending religious services of various kinds. That is not the rule the Supreme Court has adopted anywhere else. The Supreme Court has made it quite clear that there is some room between protecting free exercise rights and running afoul of the Establishment Clause, if you will. And it's hard for me to see how that rule has to be different in the prison context.
In Judge Adelman's opinion from the Gashia case, he emphasizes the prison environment and how that's different than any other environment where free exercise or Establishment Clause issue is raised.
But why is it, I mean, prisons are different, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't see how religion is being established in light of the Supreme Court's emphasis about the neutrality theory of the Establishment Clause when prison officials are told that they can't burden unduly, they can't put a substantial burden on, in the RLUIPA phrase, someone's practice of religion. People who don't want to practice religion certainly don't have to do it. No one has to practice someone else's religion.
RLUIPA goes too far in accommodating religious beliefs to the point where it elevates religion over non-religion. And
how, though? How?
It does that by creating rights for religious inmates that aren't created for non-religious inmates. And this case is an example of that. Under the First Amendment, Mr. Charles did not have a right to possess prayer oil, and Judge Crabb ruled that. However, in applying MLUPA, he does have that right. And that's a right that other inmates who are practicing or who are seeking protection for other fundamental rights aren't going to see.
But you could say the same thing even about a basic free exercise right. If an inmate has a dietary restriction, for example, under the rules of his religion, he could insist on no pork, a common dietary restriction, but other inmates don't have that right, and yet we acknowledge that that's where the Constitution requires us to go.
I understand your point, Your Honor, and those requests, obviously the different religions that are practiced from inmates are going to require different tenets of that religion, including special diet. However, in whether tangible privileges or rights to greater attention, the religious inmate is going to have the appearance of having government support and power behind him that an inmate who's not exercising a religious belief doesn't. And let me give you the example that Judge Turk gave in the Madison case out of Virginia, where an inmate who is a believer in white supremacy and a member of the Aryan Nation requests publications because that's his belief. It's a secular belief. And he's denied that because of the reasons stated by the prison officials and their regulations. However, that same inmate, a different inmate who has the same beliefs but is also a member of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, will have greater protection of that request. So the regulations will have more leeway. It's judged under a strict scrutiny analysis versus the white supremacist inmate who's just a member of the Aryan Nations. His request is going to be judged under the rational basis test. That's where the appearance of privilege and the appearance of government endorsement occurs under RLUIPA.
But where in the Supreme Court's decisions has the mere appearance without the reality of establishment of religion been enough? It seems to me the Supreme Court has been solicitous in lots of recent Establishment Clause cases to allow, for instance, student speakers to talk about religion at high school graduations, and that would have the appearance, I would think, of establishing a religion, and yet the court has said, but no, that's not the substance of what's going on. So why is there an appearance standard for you?
We can distinguish the Amos case when applied to RLUIPA. Amos and the concept of benevolent neutrality isn't applicable in this sense because the holding in Amos, the underlying principles of that, is that it alleviated substantial government interference with the missions of religious organizations, and it wasn't necessary to violate free exercise rights. When we apply that to RLUIPA, we don't have the same reasons to support that holding. Applying RLUIPA in the prison context is going to further government interference with religious exercise. And this record...
How do you say that, though?
How are you going to interfere?
It's going to...
Don't they now recognize six religions there?
They do, Your Honor. And the internal management procedure at issue in this case, they've gone through the procedure of consulting with religious leaders. They've outlined what property items would be necessary to practice that religion, and we don't have officers and guards and security directors evaluating all the different requests for property items because of that. Now, what Judge Crabb did is basically invalidate that process, that IMP, and now an inmate, even if it's not a central tenet of his religion, which is how RLUIPA defines an exercise of religion, this has to be a subjective belief in furtherance of that. When they receive these requests, they're going to become intimately involved in getting to know what, if this inmate, first of all, has a sincere belief, if this requested property or exercise is related to this religious belief,
and then they're going to have to go through the process outlined in the record of having to order this and having it come into the institution and all the problems that are, or all of the procedures that are affiliated with an inmate getting property or exercising his religion.
But they have to do that anyway to at least decide which of the six categories Judge Coffey mentioned the person falls within. Somebody could say, you know, I'm a convert to the Native American family of religions because they like eagle feathers or something. And the prison is going to have to make that determination. I mean, I think what Judge Crabb was saying is that there can be certainly case-by-case decisions made in the light of prison safety concerns and the rest, but that you do have to go through these processes so that religious rights, which Congress certainly was interested in preserving, no doubt about that, are not interfered with, are not burdened.
The problem is, Your Honor, it's not a statute of neutrality. It will involve more governmental interference. Our IMPs, if a Native American inmate wants an eagle feather, they look at the IMP 6A and they say, yes, he's allowed an eagle feather, and that property comes in.
These are the statutes that are being proposed to in the programs to further faith-based initiatives for delivery of social services are equally unconstitutional under your theory?
I don't have an opinion on that, Your Honor. I don't know enough about those statutes.
One would think if trying to work with religious organizations is so suspect, that perhaps your theory could lead in that direction.
Not with the intimate relationship that prisons have with the inmates under their custody and control. And this was noted by Judge Adelman and by Judge Turk, and it has been noted throughout Supreme Court precedent. That relationship
is a Ninth Circuit's case. I mean, we don't usually follow district courts. The Ninth Circuit didn't agree with you.
They didn't, and they applied Amos in holding that this was an accommodation of religion. And again, we distinguish Amos because it will involve more governmental interference, and it wasn't necessary. It's not necessary to protect free exercise clauses. He's not allowed prayer oil under the First Amendment free exercise clause as it's applied under Turner and Alone.
Well, they actually rely on quite a few cases, and it goes on for better than a page. They say it doesn't foster excessive entanglement. They cite Agostini. They also cite the core of presiding bishop, saying that it's got secular purpose, that the primary effect is neither to advance nor inhibit religion. It's merely lifting of a burden.
And I think what the Mayweather's court failed to acknowledge was that all other fundamental rights of an inmate are held to a lesser standard of scrutiny, except for religion. The religious inmate will have more rights in prison now than the non-religious inmate. And that's where the government shows a preference with belief over disbelief.
You're in your
rebuttal time, ma'am.
Correct. I reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Gene Scher, representing Mr. Charles. I'd like to focus today on a couple of the Establishment Clause theories that seem to have gotten most play among the district courts that have held ALUPA unconstitutional. Those theories are sort of late-breaking and have not been fully addressed in the Ninth Circuit's opinion or even by Judge Crabb. And I'd also like to explain in the process why we believe Amos, at the end of the day, is really dispositive of the Establishment Clause issues here. The first theory, and the one that that Ms. Schmelzer spent most of her time on, is what I would call the preferred rights theory under the Establishment Clause, and that is that a government can't act to protect religious freedom unless it also gives equally strong protection to other fundamental rights. Now, I think, Judge Wood, you're right that theory would cast doubt on a whole host of faith-based programs, including a program of Wisconsin that was actually upheld just a couple of weeks by this court. It would also have other sweeping implications, I think. One fundamental right is the right to privacy under the Due Process Clause. Another fundamental right is the right to to view and receive and perhaps even create sexually oriented literature under the First Amendment. Well, if the state is right on this theory, Wisconsin's elected officials, and if the state were to win on this issue, they would no longer be able to maintain their tax exemption for churches, for example, without also giving one to adult bookstores. Or closer to home, they will no longer be able to offer religious services in their prisons without also offering conjugal visits on the same terms. Fortunately,
how do you come to that?
I'm sorry?
How do you come to that reason?
Well, the right to privacy is a fundamental right, and they're essentially saying that that under the Establishment Clause, the U.S. government and the state of Wisconsin, by extension, are both obligated to protect the right to privacy to the same extent that they protect religious freedom rights. Now, Amos...
What does that have to do with the conjugal rights?
Well, conjugal rights would fall within the right to privacy. I think that
your argument is that it would have to be all or nothing on everything, either drop the Establishment Clause or add First Amendment rights or privacy rights.
That is the argument that has been made, and it has those sweeping implications, and Amos, I think, clearly rebuts that argument. As the Court is aware, Amos dealt with the exemption in Title VII. Now, Title VII prohibits not only religious discrimination, but it also prohibits discrimination based on race and sex. And it's significant that the exemption at issue in Amos was limited to religion. One might think that Congress could and perhaps should have passed an exemption that might give organizations who have a legitimate interest in race or sex discrimination the ability to discriminate on those grounds, you know, race or gender-specific advocacy groups, for example. But Congress chose not to include an exemption for those groups. Its exemption was limited to religious organizations. And the court nevertheless unanimously upheld the exemption under the Establishment Clause. They held, first of all, that the law had a legitimate purpose, namely alleviating significant governmental interference with the ability of religious organizations to define and carry out their religious missions. By analogy here, it's certainly permissible for Wisconsin, if it chose, to remove burdens on the exercise of religion by Mr. Charles. And if that's true, it's also permissible for Congress to encourage Wisconsin to do that very thing. And it's significant, I think, that the state hasn't even challenged the legitimacy of Congress's purpose in enacting this law. Now, moving to the effects prong of Lemon, Amos also rejected the argument that the exemption there failed the effects prong because it made religion better off than before. It said, for a law to have forbidden effects under Lemon, it must be fair to say that the government itself has advanced religion through its own activities and influence. And then it went on to, quoting Waltz, to say what it meant by that. It said, through sponsorship, financial support, or active involvement of the sovereign in religious activity. Now, in this case, the only person actually engaged in religious activity is Mr. Charles. Although the state regulates the property that he uses in his personal religious activity, RLUIPA doesn't require the state to get involved in his religious activity at all, and Congress has not encouraged or forced the state to subsidize his religious activity.
He uses his own money, right, to buy the prayer oil.
That's not clear from the record, but that would certainly be one way that he could get it.
Well, what was he, this has nothing to do with the prayer oil, but what was he charged with?
I'm not sure. I understand.
Serving a sentence for.
I understand some kind of financial crime, but I'm not sure about that. That's not in the record either, frankly.
Theft, perhaps?
I don't know. Perhaps. In our event, in Amos, the court also rejected the argument that Section 702 failed the effects test because it advanced religion to a greater extent than secular interest. The district court in Amos had made that basic argument, and the court said, we find unpersuasive the district court's reliance on the fact that Section 702 singles out religious entities for a benefit. Whereas here, government acts with the proper purpose of lifting a regulation that burdens the exercise of religion, we see no reason to require that the exemption come packaged with benefits to secular entities. And by the same logic, the Establishment Clause doesn't require that a reduction in governmental burdens on religion come packaged with benefits to other fundamental rights. Now, let me spend a moment if I could, and I don't want to eat into Mr. Clement's time, and I assume that white light means that I'm still okay. I'd like to say just a minute about endorsement, because that also has some play in the case law. No appellate court of which I'm aware has held that a religious exemption violates the Establishment Clause simply because it may convey a message of endorsement of religion. That, of course, would be contrary to the holding in Amos, and actually Justice O'Connor, in her concurrence in Amos, addressed this very point, and she said, essentially, that in the context of a religious exemption, endorsement has to be viewed differently. And then she picked up that point again in Wallace against Jaffrey and a couple of other decisions, indicating that when you do the analysis of what a neutral, well-informed observer would be aware of, you should assume that the neutral observer would be aware of the Free Exercise Clause and, she says, the values that underlie it. And that gives much more play to religious exemptions than it might give to other kinds of governmental interaction with religion. If the court has no further questions, I'll conclude now. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Paul Clement for the United States. When the government acts to lift government-imposed burdens on religious exercise, it does not violate the Establishment Clause. To the contrary, as the Supreme Court observed in Zorach against Clausen, in relieving burdens on religious exercise, the government follows the best of its traditions. And that's what Congress has done in enacting RLUIPA, which effectively directs state officials on a condition for receiving federal funds that they should scrutinize their programs that impose burdens on religious exercise and make sure that those programs and those restrictions do not do so absent a compelling interest such as prison security.
So you're comfortable with the idea that perhaps because of this complex interaction between the free exercise and the establishment clauses that the government is free to single out religion among fundamental rights and say, this one we're going to really make sure that we don't burden.
I think that's right, and I would say that as Mr. Shaw suggested, that's suggested by the language of the Supreme Court in Amos, but I would also suggest that one error that I think that the district courts that have struck down RLUIPA have made is that they focus on RLUIPA in isolation. And it's simply not true that the only thing with respect to state and local institutions that the federal government cares about is religious exercise. The federal government also tells state and local institutions not to discriminate on the basis of race through Title VI. It also tells them not to discriminate on the basis of sex through Title IX. It also tells them not to discriminate on the basis against individuals with disabilities through Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And then even those are all under the spending clause. It even goes further and imposes direct burdens on state prisons through Title VII and through the Civil Rights Institutionalized Persons Act, CRIPA. And so I think there are a variety of provisions of federal law that direct state institutions to respect inmates' rights. And one thing the Supreme Court reaffirmed in its school choice decision, Zelman, is that you shouldn't look at the challenge program in isolation, but rather you should look at all the various programs that are relevant in determining whether or not there's an undue preference for religion. So I don't think the focus of the district courts that somehow religious rights are being singled out is either correct in light of all the statutes or really a constitutional problem, because the Supreme Court has said that there is a free exercise clause that makes religion somewhat unique, and the government can act to accommodate religion in a way that might not be appropriate in another context. Now, certainly RLUIPA does provide greater protection for the inmate's religious rights than the constitutional minimum itself. But that alone, the fact that there is greater protection for free exercise rights, does not violate the Constitution. For if it did, numerous state constitutional provisions that provide greater free exercise protection than the federal Constitution, including Wisconsin's own Freedom of Conscience Clause, as interpreted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in State against Miller, would themselves be unconstitutional. By the same token, the specific accommodation that we're talking about in this case, the giving Mr. Charles the prayer oil, does not raise constitutional difficulties. If Wisconsin had, of its own accord, decided to offer prayer oil to Mr. Charles in addition to prayer beads and a prayer rug, as provided by its Internal Management Procedure 6A, I don't think that accommodation of his religion would have violated the Establishment Clause. It doesn't make the any greater free Establishment Clause problem if Wisconsin adopts that policy not on its own without any consideration to where the funding might be coming from, but offers Mr. Charles the prayer oil as a direct result of its interest in obtaining federal funds and with the concomitant conditions that come with those funds.
I suppose what Wisconsin is complaining about is the fact that when they've made the decision as a matter of state policy, the scrutiny given to them under the law is, under Smith, et cetera, more minimal scrutiny without RLUIPA than with RLUIPA, and why should they have to show this kind of compelling interest and this extra burden?
Well, I mean, that's an excellent point, but I think, I mean, the simplest answer to that is if they're really concerned with that, then they need not take the federal funds. I mean, because it's a condition on the federal funds and nobody's forced them to take those funds. But I would say that I think that the concerns with how difficult it is for states to comply with RLUIPA are somewhat overstated. The federal government, to which RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, validly applies, has been dealing with the same substantial burden compelling interest test under RFRA for 10 years. And that test has applied to the federal prisons operated by the Bureau of Prisons. And the Bureau of Prisons has not found the imposition of a substantial burden compelling interest test to be unduly burdensome. And in fact, courts, including this court in the Mack against O'Leary case, which I recognize has been vacated, but I still think is instructive, has recognized that the fact that there is this substantial burden compelling interest test does not mean that you throw out the idea of deference to the judgments that prison officials make. Even after RLUIPA, even after RFRA, it is still a compelling interest for correctional officials to make sure that they are maintaining the safety of their institutions. And courts can give due deference to those judgments while still protecting the religious exercise rights of inmates. And I think Judge Crabb's opinion below is an illustration of that. At the same time that she examined the rationale that Wisconsin had for banning prayer oil, at the same time that they had baby oil available at the canteen and found that rationale lacking, she also analyzed the rationale that the state had for restricting religious feasts to one religious feast per umbrella group per year and upheld that restriction as a valid prison regulation that was in fact the least restrictive alternative to further a compelling interest. So I think that in a sense, the states, and with respect, I think the district courts that have struck RLUIPA down, have tended to overemphasize how burdensome the regime of RLUIPA actually is. I think actually if you read the opinions, another thing those opinions do is they actually tend to overestimate how deferential the Turner and Arone regime is, because it's not just rational basis, as Judge Adelman suggested at one or two points in his opinion, but there is a sort of rational relation test, and some policies do get struck down even under the Turner or Arone test.
You think Turner and Arone fit most comfortably in the compelling interest part of this analysis, or do you think they belong somewhere else? If you were trying as a conscientious court to make sure that you were giving the proper deference to prison officials, where do you plug it in?
Well, I'm not sure I would plug in Arone and Turner's analysis, but the idea of deference, I think, probably fits most particularly on the compelling interest side of things. I don't think prison officials have any particular expertise in divining what is a substantial burden on religious exercise, but I do think that they have particular expertise to bear as to what's a compelling interest.
And what about least restrictive alternatives? Is deference owed to the prison officials there?
I think some deference is appropriate in that context as well, because they are going to have a sense. Certainly, when you start identifying the alternatives and there's evidence from the prison officials that those alternatives don't work, they're not really the least restrictive alternatives, they're not pragmatic, that's precisely the kind of judgment where I think courts would want to have some deference to prison officials. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. 2 minutes.
All right.
I'd just like to touch on a few points that Mr. Clements has made. Addressing the federal funding issue, because we do have a challenge here under the spending clause as well. The relationship between the federal funds and the conditions imposed under RLUIPA, there has to be some sort of nexus between those. We know that from Dole. They did the analysis there. We have to do the analysis here. The nexus, as proposed by the United States, is that it supports rehabilitation programs that do receive federal funding. There is, however, a disconnect between religious exercise and these sort of programs that receive federal funding. And there has to be under the Establishment Clause, and this court's held in cases like Kerr, well, we can't have any sort of religious components to these rehabilitative programs.
But that's not what Kerr holds. Kerr just says that if you have Narcotics Anonymous, it has a religious component to it, that might be fine for some prisoners, but that can't be the only one. You need to have an avenue that's also non-religious.
That's correct.
Rather different. And so, in fact, there are quite a few alcohol and narcotics rehabilitation programs in the prisons with a religious component for those who are comfortable with that.
But there has to be a particularized relationship, and that we don't have here. The funds that Wisconsin DOC receives are for things, bricks and mortar, education, and rehabilitation programs. And we don't have the exercise of religion in these sort of programs.
Well, you couldn't. Are you arguing that Congress could have given you money to build a church in the prison? I would be stunned if Congress passed a statute like that.
Correct. Although we are allowed to have chaplains, and obviously things like that, that facilitate the free exercise of religion. It's not necessary here to facilitate the free exercise of religion. It goes beyond that, and it grants prisoners rights, religious prisoners rights, that no other prisoners have or non-believers don't have. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.